When you take that VCM and you scramble it through the chemical process that gets you to PVC, it doesn't revert back. But it is an effective way for ENGOs and perhaps others to attack PVC because that creates a very debilitating public narrative. And then if VCM, it becomes really hard to get as a feedstock, that's going to have significant impacts to PVC down the road.
Welcome to Building Connections, presented by IPEX. In each episode, we delve into the world of construction, exploring how key leaders in the space shape the infrastructures of tomorrow. Discover the stories behind the solutions that impact municipal, commercial, and residential projects across North America.
Welcome to Building Connections. I'm your host, Greg Blackett, and today we're talking with Ann Austin, a leading environmental attorney and founder of Austin Legal and Public Affairs. Ann has worked at the highest levels of environmental policy, including serving as Principal Deputy Assistant Administrator at the Environmental Protection Agency under President Trump's first term. She's also helped shape major air, water, and waste regulations, and she now advises businesses navigating complex environmental laws. So today we're diving into the biggest challenges in environmental compliance, where policy is headed, and what businesses need to know to stay ahead. Anne, great to have you on.
Greg, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Awesome. Look, I got to ask you, what got you into environmental law? Was it something you always wanted to do, or did you just stumble into it?
So to be totally candid, I stumbled into it. I was into, I think, my second year of law school, and I was looking at the course catalog, trying to figure out what to sign up for from a class standpoint. I had a few electives available, and I was visiting with my mother, and she said, you know what? Our family's always been very interested in wildlife and habitat conservation. Why don't you see if there's an environmental law class you can take? And I thought about it, and I said, yeah, sure, why not? You know, I kind of understand that space, at least from a layperson's perspective. And within the first 2 weeks of taking that course, I had my eureka moment. The light bulb went off, and I knew immediately that this is the area of law that I was supposed to work in.
Oh, fantastic. And working at the EPA, I got to ask you, what was that like? Maybe just take us through that. Maybe what you were doing prior to the EPA, and then why change to the EPA, and what was that like?
I have had a somewhat unconventional legal career. I started off right out of law school working at the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality as an assistant general counsel. It was a wonderful job. Within a few months there, I had an opportunity to work for the chairman of the agency, Dr. Brian Shaw. And I worked for him as his kind of executive assistant special counsel for several years. And then the opportunity became available to put my name in the hat for the general counsel position, which I was lucky enough to get. So I did that for a little while longer, and then I had an opportunity to move to another state agency, the Texas General Land Office. And while I was there, I had initially started my time at the GLO as general counsel, and then was asked if I could become the chief clerk and deputy land commissioner. So I took my attorney hat on, and I put on a management hat and began managing over 600 state employees and running the agency on behalf of Commissioner George P. Bush, who set a very clear vision for where he wanted to take the agency, and I needed to help him implement it. So I've gone from being an attorney to a big manager. And then when the EPA opportunity presented itself to do a mix of both, but from a political standpoint, I leapt at the opportunity immediately to work for President Trump the first time around as the regional administrator for EPA Region 6. For those that don't know, the country is broken out into 10 different regions for EPA, and all federal agencies have a similar type of model. The Region 6 office oversees Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana. So everything coming out of EPA headquarters is then overseen by the regional administrators as the states, you know, generally implement most of those federal environmental regulatory laws and statutes, and they're kind of further pushed down to the state level. And then after about a year and a half, there was an opportunity to go up to headquarters and work in the Office of Air and Radiation as the principal deputy. And I thought to myself, wow, I never thought I'd be doing what I'm doing now. So why not take another shot at it? And I didn't think too hard about it. I said, this would be another amazing opportunity. So I went up to headquarters and spent a year and a half there, and it was a fantastic education all around.
Okay, and what made you leave? Or do those jobs have a certain lifespan and it's time to change?
They have a certain lifespan. Okay. If you were a political appointee, when the administration is out, you two are out. So I was out on inauguration morning of 2021 at that point.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I worked at Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, which is a phenomenal firm, and did that for a few years before I decided to hang out my own shingle after expanding my family.
Okay. And so you still have a perspective, I'm sure, on the EPA and maybe some upcoming changes or policy changes, if any. So I wanted to talk to you about that. You have a new administration coming in, or that's in now, Donald Trump's second term. And do you think there'll be any changes to environmental policy that will have a strong impact for companies trying to build projects or just the construction industry in general? Or do you think it would be status quo?
I think you're going to see a big change, and a big change in a very positive direction. The president has made it abundantly clear while he was on the campaign trail and every day since he's been back in the White House that he wants to unleash the power of the American economy. He wants to move forward and help the economy grow and add that down to all of the benefits that flow from that down to every single American citizen. So I do think that you're going to see a strong push towards further deregulation, which he's been very clear about. The first time around, he had stated that he wanted the federal agencies across the board to take a deregulatory approach, that for every one rule promulgated, he wanted two repealed. The goal that has been set in a recent executive order is a 10 for one. So for every rule promulgated, 10 rules that are outdated, contradictory, that don't further his vision for the economy and for energy security and independent dominance. Yeah, and I would be viewed very closely. So there's a big push in that direction. And I do think, I mean, look, our president is a real estate guy. He made his money and he made his mark on the world initially building really big projects. He understands what the construction industry needs. And he understands that deregulation is important. Folks need to be safe. He's been very clear that the environment is a big priority, but he does not believe, and I have seen it done at EPA, where it's not a zero-sum game. Economic growth and environmental improvement are not mutually exclusive. That's a false premise, if you ask me, and certainly a false narrative. And there's a path forward there. And I think it's going to be very exciting to see what happens over the next 4 years.
So that's probably good news for construction companies, the economy, jobs. Let's talk about the environment, because the EPA is there to protect the environment. And should we be concerned that there's going to be a relaxation of certain laws that were put up for a reason in the first place? Or how should we think about that from someone that's looking at it from the outside?
Sure. So having been in the building, I can assure anybody that is interested in this particular issue that very robust science and very robust legal grounds are the foundation upon which rules will be promulgated, rules will be rescinded, rules will be amended or otherwise tweaked. There is a deep appreciation for the politicals that are in the building that it is important. It is of paramount importance to be protective of human health and the environment in keeping with the statutes, the federal statutes that have been passed and signed into law. I think what we've seen, unfortunately, at EPA is that under the direction of other administrations, you've seen the rulemakers, the regulators, trend in an overly conservative manner towards standards that are so conservative that are at or even below background levels. And it's done in a way that, frankly, stifles further innovation. It stifles growth. And we've seen that effort to go above and beyond, where you go past, what is needed to be protective of human health and the environment. And I think it's time for a course correction. And I think that's probably more of the spirit in which you will see regulations proposed and finalized going forward, is more of a, can we do this? Is it practical? Will it be protective of human health and the environment? And will it let the economy flourish?
And if we're looking at the common issues facing construction companies today, what would you think they are from an environmental regulation perspective?
I think one of the major ones is just energy costs. What it costs from an energy standpoint to get a project up and going, cradle to grave kind of thing. It is expensive. It's fuel. It's the electricity. It's everything that goes into it. And again, President Trump is incredibly sensitive to those issues because he has built big projects. He knows what goes into that. It's labor costs. It's parts and materials. Where do you source it from? And all of that comes into it. But I do think that the primary driver here from a cost standpoint is going to be energy. And the president is keenly aware of that. And Administrator Zeldin is a very smart guy. He's got very smart people around him, both at the political and at the career level. And I would anticipate that he's going to be taking a very close look at that kind of fundamental issue when it comes to anything that happens within the agency where EPA regulations are in a position to otherwise impact economic growth and getting projects going.
Building Connections is brought to you by IPEX, leaders in thermoplastic piping systems, where innovation meets reliability. Elevate your infrastructure projects with our comprehensive range of products designed for durability and efficiency. Visit IPEXNA.com to discover how our solutions can enhance your next project today.
Yeah, from our perspective, one of the challenges we see often is there's a lot of noise or misinformation around just building materials, like what's sustainable, what's not. How do you define sustainability? And when it comes to construction projects, people have choices on which building materials they use. So for example, we make a lot of PVC products, which we feel are very safe and sustainable. But sometimes if you're reading about it in the news, there's a lot of information that says the opposite. So one of the challenges we have is to really clarify what we think is the safe and sustainable option. So you've seen how environmental policy impacts different industries. How do you see materials like PVC and CPVC fittings fitting into the future of sustainable infrastructure?
Oh, I think they're vitally important. At the end of the day, it's a consumer choice issue, I think, fundamentally. And what you want consumers to have is the best possible information to make a smart, informed decision, however that shakes out. I think that's something that the PVC and kind of plastics industry writ large deal with is there's a ton of misinformation out there. And I think fundamental to that, and this is just a tough one to get over because it is so pervasive within kind of the greater media narrative, is that plastics are made fundamentally from fossil fuels. And we know how the media feels about fossil fuels as an entire energy category. So that's what you're fundamentally fighting. So when folks talk about plastics, it all builds on itself, starting with fossil fuels and then all of the derivatives that get you to plastics, which are petroleum-based products. So that, I think, is the big fundamental challenge that PVC and plastics are up against. Now, that doesn't change the fact that there is a tremendous amount of science out there, studies, testing, monitoring, data collection that's been done for decades at this point that substantiates a very real, very positive narrative that is backed by the science that PVC is a phenomenal material. It is sustainable. It is long-lasting. Its greenhouse gas life cycle calculations are usually superior to those of the competitors within your ductile iron, copper, concrete space. It's lighter and cheaper to make. It's easier to transport. So from a fuel saving standpoint, you've got that going for you. It lasts for a very long time. It doesn't have the corrosive issues that other piping materials usually have. So there's a great story to tell, and there's wonderful information to get in consumers' hands. And I think at the end of the day, people know that, but it's almost like playing a game of whack-a-mole against all of the stories that are constantly flying about, we're worried about some emission out of a PVC facility, or we think that there might be benzenes or dioxins leaking out of PVC pipe. If you look at the studies, it's not an issue at all. But you don't have those same sound bites flicking back that same information. So you wind up with a lopsided narrative, which is really unfortunate because it's not accurate and it leads people towards making decisions that actually they may not be particularly happy with the long-term environmental or human health impacts of those decisions if made now with that half picture of what the real options look like.
Yeah. And it's definitely a challenge, and it's a science-based approach. Like you mentioned, we conduct life cycle analysis on our products, and it's an ISO standard methodology that measures various health and human impacts. And you can do that across material types. And time after time, it reveals the PVC option is the preferred metric or preferred material across most of those metrics. We're fortunate and to understand that and have the real data. It's just difficult to communicate all of that, like you said, to the consumer. And we're battling the massive media out there that's picking up on stories that maybe aren't true. And unfortunately, consumers are confused and they don't necessarily know what's right. It is a challenge for sure. Switching gears a bit, in terms of laws like the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, how have they impacted construction projects? And do you see that changing in the future as well?
No, so I don't think that you're going to see any really significant changes under those existing statutes. They've been around for years. I mean, the last time that you saw an update to the Clean Air Act were the amendments in 1990. So I don't think that you're going to see anything really, you know, significant coming out of there in terms of a novel regulatory read of either of those. What could happen is you could see things like certain guidances either being rescinded or finalized or drafted and put out for more general notice and comment that might otherwise make it easier or perhaps under a different administration, more challenging to move forward with a construction project. I think what you will continue to see and what will be challenging, because you don't see a lot happening under those two statutes in terms of a direct impact, as you've asked. I think what you're going to see more of is what is happening within the ENGO sue and settle space or petitions for rulemaking, most notably as it relates to PVC, what's happening with vinyl chloride monomer. Folks, again, are using that as a means of going after PVC as the end product, suggesting that because VCM is a known carcinogen, that somehow that makes PVC a cancer-causing substance, which to anybody that knows and understands the science, that is not how it works. It's just not. And I won't get into that here because I know that you've got other folks that could explain it in a far superior, more technically accurate way than I can. But the way that I've discussed it with others is imagine taking an egg. You crack the egg, you put it in a frying pan and you scramble it. You will not be able to get that scrambled egg back to its original form. No matter what you do, it's not going to go back into an egg white and encompassed within an eggshell. A similar thing happens when you take that VCM and you scramble it through the chemical process that gets you to PVC, it doesn't revert back. But it is an effective way for ENGOs and perhaps others to attack PVC because that creates a very debilitating public narrative. And then if VCM, it becomes really hard to get as a feedstock, that's going to have, you know, significant impacts to PVC down the road. Whether or not that's going to be successful certainly remains to be seen, but folks that, again, don't like plastics, that don't like fossil fuels are going to continue to go after all of the fossil fuel and fossil fuel adjacent industries with everything that they've got. They're very smart. They're very savvy. They fundraise tremendous amounts of money off of these types of efforts, and they will just keep coming at you.
And how do they go out? What's their end game? Is it to get the EPA to maybe put it on a banned substance list or banned material list, or where do they go from there here? And what do you think the EPA's position is today on some of the chemicals you mentioned and PVC in general?
I think what you could see happen, I don't know that there's an appetite for it to happen right now. You've got really smart people at EPA at both the political and the career level that understand what the science is. And the career folks really do take the scientific integrity part of their job very seriously. And I think that making a huge leap from VCM being a known carcinogen to somehow extrapolating out that, oh, then PVC must be too because it's a part of its main constituent is VCM, is a bit of a leap given the polymerization process that it goes through. But it won't be for a lack of trying from outside third parties. So one thing that I would encourage anybody who's in the PVC space, and if you're in the plastic space in general, this extends out to anyone, when EPA is going out for notice and comment for an ANPRM, for an NPRM, industry players need to comment on these rules. They need to show up. They need to bring the data and the science that counters what's being proposed and what's being posited from an underlying assumption standpoint. You got to fight it with everything that you have, because otherwise EPA, because it's the way that the federal government works under the Administrative Procedures Act, they make their decisions based on what is provided in the record. And if the record is lopsided, there's only so much they can do about that. When I was in the building the first time around, it was hilarious. You had industry groups coming in saying, we want you to do X. Great, that sounds reasonable. I've talked to my attorneys about that. We see where you're going. Okay, thank you. We can go out for a proposed rulemaking. We can try to do guidance, but we need you to help us fill in the blanks from like a technical standpoint, a scientific standpoint, because all I've got right now is this body of evidence that has been provided to the agency over time or that is otherwise in the public record. I don't have anything of what you're telling me, and I just can't take it on good faith. The public needs to be able to see it. They need to be able to comment on it. And we need to be able to establish that there's a firm record upon which to base a regulatory decision. And more often than not, when push came to shove, unfortunately, you had a lot of members of industry that said, we don't want to take a public position, or maybe this is confidential business information. We're not comfortable sharing X, Y, or Z. That's their prerogative. I won't knock them for it. But at the end of the day, you've got to fight science with science. You have to fight data with data. And if you don't feel like you're getting a fair shake, then you need to show up with the goods. And I think that is always going to be the case, where you have industry that is doing its best to be compliant with environmental laws and regulations at both the state and federal levels that are trying to be good public stewards. And don't get me wrong, I know every industry has its bad apples. But for the most part, I do think that within kind of the American corporate culture, there's a very strong will to do the right thing and to be in compliance. But you've got NGOs, political actors, private citizens, whomever, that feel very strongly about environmental purity, for lack of a better way of putting it, and want to do and will stop at nothing to push that agenda forward, even if it is to the detriment of the American economy, American growth. And it's a zero-sum game to them. And they're going after business. And folks need to just reconcile that and say, okay, if they're willing to raise and spend a ton of money to do this, we need to be very clear-headed about that and just have your eyes wide open.
Yeah. And I imagine the EPA doesn't have the resources to independently verify everything. I mean, they probably try, but they're also reliant on the industry providing them with the data points. And like you say, if it could be easily lopsided if the industry doesn't fill that role. And I don't think we're used to that, to be honest. It's a somewhat new thing. The industry is built based on material scientists, not necessarily PR and marketing. And so we're not necessarily used to having to do that. But I think the good news is there's so much science out there. Like you mentioned, the industry has a lot. We have a lot. And it's just getting plugged into and making sure we're able to tell the right stories. So yeah, that's really good feedback. Any other thoughts that you wanted to talk about today?
One thing I would add is just for anybody, if it's a trade association, if it's an individual company that really wants to get a better understanding of how the agency operates and what they do and what they, you know, may hope to do. And I don't have any, you know, unique insights into what that universe looks like. One thing I would love to do is dispel a myth, which is it's a black box. Call, ask for a meeting, ask them questions. They will ask you questions, but engage. It's worth the effort. It's worth the time. And you'd probably be very surprised with the level of information sharing and candor that you would get out of folks at the federal regulatory level. It does not need to be off-putting. It's not scary, I promise. I loved it when people came into the building. It was great. I always learned something. I always came away from those meetings with a better understanding of what industry or individual companies or states or individual communities needed, wanted, what they tried, what worked, what didn't. So it's a tremendous learning and in some cases a teaching exercise as well. So I would say to anyone that's interested, reach out if it's to your regional office, if it's to the folks at headquarters, and just say, hey, I have an idea. I have a question. I want to understand what you're doing and how it's going to impact us. And maybe you'll take some of our feedback, because that's usually a very welcome approach. And it's better to get in early and establish those relationships and talk to people so that you're at the table when ideas are being crafted, which might lead to a regulation or a rescission or an amendment, as opposed to being involved at the 11th hour when something's been proposed and you're looking at something saying, if I had known they were going to go in that direction, I would have tried to have spoken with them sooner and said, hey, would you consider this approach? Because we think that it addresses X, Y, and Z, whereas you're really only dealing with one out of those three. You can be more comprehensive, and this is what it's going to get you. So I would just say, engage early and often. Do not be put off by the fact that it's folks in Washington, D.C. They are smart people. They're generally friendly people, and they would prefer the engagement than hearing from industry or companies later in the game.
That's great feedback, and it makes sense. They're there to engage with industry, and what better way to do that than to have those conversations? And I agreed earlier, the better. And I'd imagine they would also help inform, in our case, if we approach them, what they're working on as well. So, you know, it's maybe a bit of a two-way street in terms of things that haven't been announced, or if they're working on something that's not on their website, the earlier, the better, for sure. Yeah.
You nailed it, Greg.
Yeah, that's great. This has been really informative. I thought it was a really great conversation. Is there any other things that you'd want to talk about or cover today?
I think that covers it. It's been a wonderful conversation. It's been great getting to know you a bit more. And if there's ever anything I can do, please don't hesitate to let me know.
For sure. This has been great. Thanks, Anne. Much appreciated.
Thanks. Y'all take care.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Building Connections. You can find links to all of the resources mentioned in today's episode in the show notes. If you're finding value in our podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us connect with more listeners like you. Don't miss out on future episodes. Keep listening and building connections with us.